The beauty of the book of Esther is that we know how it ends. We already know the end from the beginning, which is very much unlike our lives, but also very much like our lives, because at the end of it all, we do know how our lives will end. It's like reading a detective novel the second time through, and now suddenly, all those apparently random events, all of those weird little anomalies that you didn't see the first time, all fit into the larger unfolding plot and all make sense. Once again, this is like and unlike our lives, because we, in theory, we know how it's all going to end, but we feel a lot like Esther and Mordecai, where the next step is a mystery. What's going to happen tomorrow? How will it all work out? And so the wonderful thing about Esther is that God has given us a book to remind us how his plan for our lives will work itself out. God has provided a book where the future of the people of God is hanging in the balance. Total annihilation, genocide, is a very real threat. We have a bunch of people. They're not very impressive. In fact, they seem to be pawns of the most powerful forces at the time, making even ambiguous decisions. And yet the will of God to save his people is done. The book of Esther has begun, we have seen, with a selfish king who plays with people's lives and whose selfish whims impact on the lives of all around him. He has put on a party of 187 days to impress everyone and to gain support for his war in Greece. The fragile illusion of control was shaken when his wife refused his drunken demands and she was cast off for her rebellion. And so our story picks up a little later on with Ahasuerus returned from his wars in Greece, probably around 4 years later, and his humiliating defeat. And what we're going to see here now is, in his depression, how he is manipulated by flattering advisors, all to set the ball in motion, which will result in Esther being exalted to a place where she will be used by God to save Israel. So today, as we introduce our main characters, as you like, Esther and Mordecai, we'll be looking firstly at King Ahasuerus and how he makes his choice for a new queen. And secondly, we want to introduce Esther and Mordecai and how they come to be in the picture. So read with me again, verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what had been done and what had been decreed against her. So, vague words. After these things. What things? Ahasuerus is back from his failed invasion to Greece. Our text makes no mention of it, but the original audience would have known all about it. This is one of the greatest wars of the era. Everyone would have known what was implied in the subtext. Here is how one commentator talks of this particular failed military campaign. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus as we know him, his attack on Greece is one of the most famous military expeditions in world history. He is famous or infamous as the Persian king who led the unsuccessful invasion of Greece in 480 BC, rendered memorable ever afterwards by the narrative of Herodotus in books 7 to 9 of his famous history. Quoting Herodotus, it says, "The army was indeed greater than any other in recorded history. There was not a nation in Asia that he did not take with him against Greece. Save for the great rivers, there was not a stream his army from that was not drunk dry. Some nations provided ships, others formed infantry units. From some, cavalry was requisitioned. From others, horse transports and crews. From others, again, warships for floating bridges or provisions and naval craft of various kinds. An incredible army, the biggest of its kind known to man. And it failed." So that's what's happened in the gap. And that's now where our text picks up. Imagine how he feels. Here is a freshly humbled man. He will be, no doubt, sitting in his self-pity maybe self-loathing. He'll be looking over the past, thinking about what mistakes he had made, who he can blame for the terrible defeat and losses and humiliation he has suffered. He is now infamous for having the biggest army in the world and failing. And in the midst of this time of humiliation, what's he also pondering? Vashti, and what happened to her? Pride comes before a fall, and Ahasuerus has fallen. His ego is crushed. The financial weight of the war would have been heavy. The many strains of a failed invasion would be hard upon him. The expenses of the 187-day party, unrecouped. Wasted money down the toilet. These times of difficulty and humiliation are good for us as sinners because we need a reality check. And the Lord often uses these times of difficulty in our lives, isn't it? It's often during these dark times when our hearts are broken, when our consciences are soft, that we are more willing to see our need, that we are more willing to see that we are broken and call out to God for help. Here, the illusion of our strength, the illusion of control, it's broken. And now maybe we will call out to God. Is this what Ahasuerus does? No. With that in mind, observe his response to the setback. You'll remember there in verse 1, it says, he's thinking of Vashti's removal. It says, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. What's missing from this little remembrance? What he had done and what he had decreed against her. Do you see how it's presented? In very neutral terms. What's missing is his personal responsibility. He had escalated the matter. He had sought out advice. He had carried out the advice of his advisors and put her away. Now, during times of brokenness like these, you have a choice, don't you? You can either focus on your sins, or we look at other people's sins. We see ourselves as the villain that we actually are, or, oh, woe is me, I'm such a victim. Everyone is against me. I have such a hard time of it. And we get angry at everyone else because we're so brilliant at focusing on other people's wrongs and not our own. Ahasuerus had made a drunk, angry, and rash decision, and he's not owning it. He's not owning the guilt, he's having a pity party because he cannot have what he actually misses. He still wants his cake and to eat it. And he feels sorry for himself now. Poor him. Does this sound familiar? Isn't this exactly what we are like in our irrationality and our sinfulness? We are so irrational and self-deceiving in our sin that when we ruin a situation with our own sins, we then cry, "Victim!" That's what we're like. That's what we do. This is why the words of Psalm 51, verse 3 and 4 are so helpful. David, in confessing and owning his sin, writes, "For I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment." A true sign of repentance is owning our own sins. And here he is, Ahasuerus. He's sad because he cannot have what he wants. And instead of learning and growing and doing the right things, he mopes. And it's interesting to see how he mopes. We can look at this and call it toxic mopiness. Because he's so mopey that the young men who are around him serving him see that he is so sad, he is broadcasting how unhappy he is to the whole palace, that they feel they have to rush in and help him stop being so sad. And it goes from bad to worse. Look at verses 2 to 4. "Then the king's young men who attended him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the woman. Let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. The king, you'll notice, is not taking advice from his typical counselors. Perhaps he has come to distrust them. Traditionally, the king would choose a wife from amongst the noble families, among whom were his advisors. We saw that last time. But this has been suspected as feeding into the sort of counsel the princes and nobles originally gave to Ahasuerus. Remember, it was the original noble families who said, get rid of this woman. Maybe they were entertaining secretly hopes that one of their daughters would be the next queen for this man. So maybe there's a legitimate reason why he's not going to his normal advisors. But here we see the king instead accepts bad advice from his young men. Advice which appeals to his pride. Advice which appeals to his lust. The Bible warns over and over again of bad counsel. Rehoboam is most famous for this. You remember Solomon's son? Solomon has died and his son Rehoboam comes to the throne. Solomon has put heavy taxes upon the people to build his grand palaces and building projects. The people are chafing and they want some tax breaks, and they approach Rehoboam and say, please, give us a break. What does Rehoboam do? He goes and speaks to his mates, and the young men give him some advice, and the advice is, double down. Double down. You threaten them and you tell them what's what. Show them who's boss. Flex your authority and let them know you are in control. Or think of the opening of the Psalm, Psalm 1 verse 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. I appreciated one of the commentators who drew out this application. He said, anytime we do business in the church and as a church, we need an intergenerational influence. Imagine only the young men made all the decisions. That would be bad for the church, wouldn't it? No offense to the young men. We need the older folk. We need the woman to be involved. This is why we have a congregational church government. The advice, of course, we see is despicable, but it is keeping with the harsh realities of the time where people were just property. It was advised that the most beautiful woman in the whole kingdom, remember this is a very large kingdom, be brought to Ahasuerus that he could decide which one would become his queen. We are told that this pleased the king and he did so. So here is a man with a rare opportunity. He's sitting there freshly defeated. He's got a rare moment of personal introspection where he might be able to see his own mistakes and go in a better direction. Now, a wise counselor could use these failures to gently guide him in the right direction, but what does this man opt for? He drowns his sense of guilt and failure in lust and indulgence. We can see that his sense of guilt is shallow. He is too easily diverted from his guilt. Now, sadly, he follows the path that we so often follow. This is Ahasuerus, my friends, is a mirror of what we are like in our sins. When we are feeling down because of our failures, when we are feeling sorry for ourselves because we've broken something, instead of saying sorry, what do? We try to soothe our conscience. We try to drown our guilt. We try to distract ourselves with sin. We see sin as a possible solution and a balm to try and fix the ache that we're feeling inside. And instead of taking it to God, instead of owning up to it, instead of confessing to the brokenness, we resort to sin as the solution, and it is not. Now, it might make you very angry to see this in Ahasuerus, and very angry to see how he's treating these young women and objectifying them in such terrible ways. And it should make us angry when we see someone with so much power being so selfish. But we're just the same. We just don't have the power. We're just as selfish. We just don't have the same power. Now, friends, this is where we must think of Christ. We cannot help but compare this king with the King of Kings. This terrible king whose bouts of anger and self-pity make for an unpredictable ruler. His subjects would be trembling with fear. He might have a tantrum, and who knows who will be the victim of his tantrum. On top of this, it is very clear that this selfish ruler is too easily manipulated. Here are these young men, not very wise, and appeals to pride and appeals to lust and appeals to a sense of entitlement are indulged, are entertained by this man. This man who is supposed to rule is ruled by skilled manipulators. The tragedy is that many lives are in his hands. Friends, we need a better king than Ahasuerus. We need Christ. We need a king who is holy, a king who is good, a king who is just, a king who is not subject to whims and bouts of selfishness, a king who cannot be manipulated, a king who is not fickle and driven by lust. And this is Christ. Christ did not seek out his bride from among the most beautiful and worthy in the world. Rather, this glorious God and King humbled himself in a search and rescue mission. He took us from the mud of our sins, from the prison of our desires, from the enslavement of the devil, from the tyranny of death, from death row itself because we were under judgment. He took an ugly, unworthy criminal prostitute and paid for her release at cost to his own life. Finally, marrying her to himself. He is the king that we need. He is the humble king. But let's consider Mordecai and Esther in this section. Read with me verses 5 to 7. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So finally, here we are. We arrive at those who we know are the main characters, Mordecai and Esther. Our text opens by stressing Mordecai is a Jew. Before it tells us his name, it tells us that he is a Jew, that he is in exile in Susa, one of the four capitals of Persia. Mordecai probably worked in the courts. He had a high up position. And Mordecai, you know, a lot of people look to the Bible for names. Would you call your child Mordecai? Mordecai is the Hebrew version of the Babylonian name, which means follower of Marduk, a Babylonian god. Okay? Follower of Marduk. That's what Mordecai means. So if you choose Mordecai as a name for your child, it's because of the person that he was, not because of the meaning of the name. And that's completely legitimate. We called our son Aaron, which means dog. And we didn't choose it because of the meaning of the name. Sorry, is it Caleb? It means dog. Yeah, we go. But because of the character in the scriptures. Whether he had a Jewish name at all, we are not told. We know Esther has two names, but Mordecai is just Mordecai. His heritage is highlighted for us. He is a Benjaminite, the same tribe as King Saul. And here we are, 120 years after exile into Babylon. How long was the exile supposed to last? 70 years. So we're 120 years into the exile. The question raised is this: what is he still doing here? Why is he still in Persia? Why is he still in exile? Why didn't he go back to the promised land? The Jews were given permission to return. In fact, they were enabled by Cyrus, you'll remember, in Ezra 1, verse 2 and 3. But it seems that many Jews were too comfortable with their lives in exile. Remember, they'd been told to build houses, to start businesses, to take wives, to settle down, to pray for the peace of the city, and then after 70 years, go home. Some of them didn't go home. They liked their life in Babylon and preferred Babylon to Israel. And here we are, several years and generations later, with Mordecai, a man still in exile. Mordecai's descendants made that choice for him, and here he is, a Jew who is quite well integrated into the situation. And then we're told about Esther. We're told that her Jewish name is Hadassah. Hadassah is, it refers to the myrtle tree. The myrtle tree has connotations of hope and restoration after exile. It seems that this is a prophetic name for this particular period. The myrtle tree was used as a building material in the Feast of Booths. And there are various promises in the prophets that link the blooming of the myrtle tree in the wilderness with restoration in places like Isaiah 41 verse 19, 55 verse 13, and Zechariah 1 verse 10 and 11. But she had a second name, a Persian name, Esther. And this means star, after the possibly after the shape of the flower of the myrtle tree. Some people think it means it comes from the name Ishtar, which is the goddess of love and war, but that's unsubstantiated. But what is important to note is this, is that this girl lives in two worlds. She has two identities and she has two names, which will become relevant for seeing how she negotiates these two identities moving forward. We're told that she is an orphan and she is being raised by Mordecai, a cousin, as a family member, because he is a family member. Now, we're told that Esther is beautiful, which prepares us to see that she's going to be swept up in Ahasuerus' scheme to search for a new queen. Look at verses 8 to 11. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the woman. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. So here we see that she is swept up in this process of gathering the most beautiful woman in the land and being brought to the king to choose a wife. Josephus reckons that around, he's a Jewish historian, he reckons that around 400 young women qualified for the finals for this quest for a new queen. Now, this particular event should not be given the respectable name of a beauty contest, because these young women were put into a house of women. So we have the word harem, but that word is quite a recent word. It would be just called the house of women. And there they would stay for the rest of their lives. They may only have one night with the king, never to be seen by him ever again, and be kept woman in the house of woman. Now, this particular way of choosing a wife was atypical in terms of how a king would ordinarily choose his wife. We've already said that a wife would be found from amongst the families of the nobles. But here we see the providence of God ensuring that Esther is put in a proper position. Some of these women might have thought the opportunity was a privilege and would be happy to be a kept woman living in the lap of luxury. This no doubt violates our modern sensibilities. And we must not think that the girls alone were victims in this situation. Apparently, the king of Persia would castrate 500 boys a year to serve in his royal palaces. This was an age where people were treated as property and there were no rights. The question is raised, and I'm sure you're asking this question yourself. How could Mordecai and Esther have willingly participated in such an event? Would you bring up your daughter to enter her to become a member of a king's harem? Is this what you would do with one of your daughters? The 15th century Jewish commentator Abraham Saba writes this. Now when Mordecai heard the king's herald announcing that whoever had a daughter or a sister should bring her to the king to have intercourse with an uncircumcised heathen, why did he not risk his life to take her to some deserted place to hide until the danger would pass? He should have been killed rather than submit to such an act. Why did Mordecai not keep righteous Esther from idol worship? Why was he not more careful? Where was his righteousness, his piety, and his valor? She, Esther too, should have, by right, have tried to commit suicide before allowing herself to have had intercourse with him. So those are just some of the opinions on whether this behavior is good or bad. The text does not comment on the internal motivations of either Mordecai or Esther. But it does force the question upon you and I. What would we have done in this situation? How should we live as exiles in Babylon? How should we be the faithful people of God? What about Daniel and his three friends? How would they have acted in this sort of situation? One of the difficulties that any commentator on Esther has is whether Esther is a good person or a bad person all the time, or whether Mordecai is a good person or a bad person all the time. You know, sometimes we have comments on a person's righteousness, like Daniel. We know he did good because the text makes it clear. But here there's no comment. It's descriptive, not prescriptive. So here is my personal take. And as an interpreter, I have to decide which way I think the evidence of the text leans. So here is how I understand the book of Esther as we look at their behavior unfolding throughout this book. Mordecai and Esther were typically integrated Jews, very comfortable and very part of their culture, 120 years after the exile. Okay? Where we start, they're not in a very good place. But this will change as we move through the book. Their Jewishness was peripheral. In fact, we see that they even hid it. Now, some people have tried to argue. They've tried to rescue Mordecai and Esther by saying, well, maybe there was some good reason that we're not told about for why they did it. You know, we see Haman comes up later and he was full of prejudice towards the Jews. Maybe Mordecai in his high position knew that there was some sort of racist anti-Semitism thing going on, and maybe that's why he did what he did. We're not told those things. That's just us trying to make it look better. We don't know. There is an instinct in us to rescue our favorite Bible characters from a bad reputation because we're so used to reading the Old Testament for moral lessons. We're so used to preaching sermons like Dare to be a Daniel. And so we find it difficult to see when our favorite characters like Gideon or Jephthah aren't really good guys at all. In fact, they're probably a lot worse than we realized because of what we were taught in Sunday school. My impression is that both Mordecai and Esther don't start well, but they do end well. That as persecution begins, they begin to grow in their faith and in their obedience. They begin integrated. They begin unrecognizable as the people of God at the beginning. But when stands need to be taken, when persecution begins to fall, when personal position and even their lives need to be risked in obedience to God to save his people, they rise to the challenge. So I think it's mixed. I think as we start in these early chapters, all of those questions that we have, they're legitimate questions. And they may not be those perfect examples that we may have made them out to be in the past. But in many ways, that's helpful for us. It has been pointed out where we might be willing to preach a sermon, Dare to be a Daniel. No one has, at this point in Esther's life, preached a sermon, Dare to be an Esther. Would anyone read chapter 2 and say, and now go be Esther? Anyone? We wouldn't do that at this point, would we? Daniel and Esther, compare them for a moment. Daniel stood up for his God. He lived a life in exile in accordance with the law. Remember the food laws. He wouldn't even eat certain foods. He did not hide his allegiances, but Esther submitted. She hid. Now, we can relate to characters like this, can't we? Sometimes we hide our own witness. Sometimes we don't let our lights shine. But Christ, of course, has called us to let our lights shine in the darkness. Sometimes, like Esther, we may even be willing to make compromises to get ahead in the world. She got ahead by compromising. And it seems that she was a good girl and she excelled at what she did and she soon won favor, but it's not for her godliness that she is commended. Living in exile, acclimatized to the values of the generation of Jews who had succumbed to the culture around them, they were not being holy as God was holy. They were being swept up in what was going on around them, not distinguishing themselves from the world yet. So let me conclude. We are using the book of Esther to think more deeply on the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. We've preached through the topic of providence, and so we always want to bring it back to this as well. We want to see how God is at work in order that we might understand how he is working in our lives as well. So the introduction of our main characters through whom God will save his people is quite underwhelming, isn't it? Underwhelming. We have all sorts of questions about their worthiness, about their obedience. But this, I think, is a part of the lesson that we must learn. God, we have already seen, has used the selfishness and the vanity of the narcissistic king, Ahasuerus, to make room for Esther. Who's in control of the situation? God is. Is God sovereign over sin? Yes. Is God sovereign over the sin of the unbeliever? Yes. We preached, I think, a whole sermon on that. But what about sin in the life of a believer? Is God sovereign over that sin as well? Well, we affirmed that, didn't we? And now we see here in the case of Esther and Mordecai that he is able to use the half-hearted and lukewarm decisions that we might make, that even get us into hot water at times. Just as God does not approve of the sins of the unbelievers, God hates the sin in believers as much as he hates the sin in the lives of unbelievers. The sin always comes from us and our hearts and not from him. He is not the author of sin. Yet, when the flesh fails to fulfill what we expect, God's plans are stronger than the weakest link that he employs in bringing his plans to pass, which is us. We're the weakest link. Both sinful king and sinful saints fall within God's power to bring his will to pass. This does not make excuses for us to sin. We must pursue holiness and be holy as he is holy. We must keep trusting, despite the sin that we see prospering in society around us, despite the fact that those in power seem to have the power to change our lives forever, as Ahasuerus does with these women in this chapter. But like that detective novel, we now know how it's all going to end. That God's purposes will prevail. Let's pray.